Going Linux, episode 149, listener feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
Whether you are new to Linux, moving from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about upgrading to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all of our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
Today's episode is Listener Feedback, and it's brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 titles. If you are a regular listener, you already know that we have a special URL that lets you get a free audiobook from Audible when you sign up for a 14-day free trial.
Whether you're a regular listener or a new listener, if you haven't signed up, the place to get your free audiobook and 14-day trial is www.audiblepodcast.com/goinglinux. And you've probably heard this before, there's currently no Audible player that will run natively in Linux. So before you sign up, make sure you can either run the player under Wine or that you have a portable device like an Android or other smartphone that can run the Audible player.
Good advice, Tom. All right, well, I have a little bit of news here.
All right.
I have been corresponding with a listener named Michael, and we'll hear his email, at least one of the several emails that he has exchanged with me. But before we get into that, I wanted to let you know that Michael has done an excellent job on creating some video tutorials on how to use the Calc spreadsheet application in LibreOffice. And he's put those on YouTube, and you can get them at youtube.com/thefrugalcomputerguy, all one word.
Mm-hmm.
Or he also has a website called thefrugalcomputerguy.com. And he has 23 video tutorials on how to use LibreOffice Calc. He starts off very, very basic and gets into some more advanced topics as the episodes go on. And in fact, he has some ODS formatted spreadsheets that you can download from his website that you can use to follow along with his lessons. So, Michael, good job. I really like him.
Excellent. I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Well, in a similar vein, I have some news. I was talking to a listener who goes by the handle Jack Death, D-E-T-H.
Yeah, I know.
And Jack other Death. other people have suggested this to me, but he finally made it clear so I could understand it. And here's the deal. You know I'm trying to get rid of Skype.
Yeah.
As a phone.
Right.
So I've already got Google Voice. And Google Voice, you can set it up so that you've got one number for the rest of your life,
uh-huh.
or for as long as Google lasts.
Right.
And then you can go online and tell it which of your telephones you want it to ring when somebody calls that number.
Uh-huh.
And Jack pointed out that one of the selections is Google Chat. And I always thought chat, as in text chat.
Right.
I don't want somebody to call me and get into a text chat. That's just not going to work. Well, no. It's voice. I think you have to be running either the Chrome or Firefox browsers, and you have to have Gmail open. I think. I've just started experimenting.
Right. Yes, that is absolutely true. Google Chat is both text and connects into Google Voice.
Yeah.
And if you want to receive it on Google Chat, you do have to have a browser open.
Right.
I'm not aware that there's a separate client for Linux or Windows or Mac or anything that is a Google Chat client that runs independently of a browser, although I'm sure somebody could come up with something like
that.
Sure. But it's pretty handy to be able to ring any phone you want, including the phone on your web browser, if you considered Google Chat that way.
Yeah.
So is that what you've decided to use, or are you still testing it out?
just started playing with it last night or the night before last night. And, yeah, it's a little bit quirky yet. It took me a while to figure out how to answer the darn thing. But I think I could go Skype free.
Okay, that's good.
In other words, Microsoft free.
Yeah, even better.
Yeah.
I had tried experimenting myself with Google Voice and had a separate line from our Google Voice voicemail line connected to my cell phone so that it would ring my cell phone and downloaded from the Android App Store. Excuse me, Marketplace. Can't use that App Store. That's trademarked by the Apple folks. So I downloaded the Google Chat or Google Voice or whatever it was, and it works perfectly on my Android phone. So
there you go.
I've tested it out with that, and of course I know you're using an iPhone 5 or 6 or something like that, right?
Oh, right. Yeah. Right.
yeah. So I'm sure there are applications for most of the smartphones out there, but I know it works beautifully with Android, as you would expect, since Android is also from the Goog.
Yep.
So good luck with that. So maybe next time we'll be recording using Google Chat.
Yeah, I think then you'd have to call me on the phone, and right now we're using Skype.
Okay. Well, either way, we can still go back to the Linux Basics Mumble server if we need to.
There you go.
Yeah. So that would work out either way. So just let me know, Tom, and I won't be calling you on Skype anymore if it all works out.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Okay.
it's only $6 a month to have the number from Skype. But Microsoft's getting that money.
Yeah, that's true. And with Google Chat, though, you know, one advantage for both of us is we won't have to get dressed up in a suit and tie for that video conference that we have every time, you know, so because it's only audio. But
I might even put pants on.
Well, I'm glad the camera's only from the waist up, so that's all right. All right. So shall we get into our emails and the stuff that our listeners are actually tuning in to listen to?
I think we better.
Okay. All right. Our first one is from Bill in Michigan, who wrote about Mint Debian and the rolling release. Bill wrote, "Hi, Tom and Larry." Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Larry, a few episodes ago, I heard you mention how you've switched to Linux Mint Debian. There must be others like me who would love to hear your experiences with it. Here is one topic I found running Mint Debian as a VM in VirtualBox. Package managing. Wow, the rolling release keeps you on your toes and a new level of awareness. Packages are being replaced constantly, and I noticed it's not always straight updates on packages, but complete replacement with other packages. This forced me to learn more about Synaptic custom filters than I ever did before. Many packages ended up as automatic removable or orphaned. Packages in these two categories seem to have been replaced or are former dependencies, but I'm not sure the exact difference. As an example, I just removed two, quote, orphaned packages. Up popped another. Removed that, and up popped another. Removing that completed what must have been a chain of dependencies. I find this fascinating, but I'm easily amused. And the sheer number of updates. I got the data for almost 4 weeks, July 3rd to the 30th. In that time, there were 402 upgraded, 30 new installed, and about 34 auto-removable / orphaned packages. That's over 100 a week.
Wow.
A little tip, if you use Synaptic or Update Manager, find the timestamped logs for package history in /root/.synaptic/log. Someday it may get you out of trouble. I'm not certain apt-get actions are logged, something I must find out. How about a whole show on a rolling release as in Mint Debian? Keep up the good work. Later, guys. Bill in Michigan.
I guess the ball's in your court on that. I'm not running Mint.
Right.
What about sudo apt-get space auto-remove?
Yeah, that might work, but I have an even better suggestion. But before we get into that, why don't you read Richard's email, and then I'll follow up with my comment that I wrote to Bill that applies to Richard as well.
Okay. He says, hi, guys.
Hi, Richard.
I tried installing Linux Mint Debian Edition on my Acer netbook computer, and I had two problems. Number one, the installer made me use gparted, which I had used years before when I think it was called qtparted. Since I was somewhat familiar with it, I was able to set up the partitions okay. New users would have a lot of trouble with that. Number two, after the installation, I checked for updates, and it wouldn't do the updates. It wanted me to fix the broken files before it would continue to update. Now, why would you want that to happen? Do they think the average person knows how to fix broken files? I decided to switch back to Linux Mint, not Debian. I am downloading version 11 now. Debian never seems to work, in my opinion. I don't have a lot of patience for this kind of stuff. I guess I'm just not a dedicated Linux user. I always like your podcast. Good work, guys. Richard. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, it's not that you're not a dedicated Linux user. You're an average user.
Yeah.
I think so. So I had responded to Richard, and this will apply to Bill as well, and anyone else wanting to take a look at Linux Mint Debian Edition. Here's my email. I agree that LMDE, Linux Mint Debian Edition, is not for the newbie, or even for the average Linux user. You're right. Requiring the user to use the partition editor during the installation is not newbie-friendly. Also, it is based on Debian, and depending on which branch of Debian you're using, it's not the most stable distribution out there. I definitely recommend Mint 11, the Ubuntu-based version, over LMDE for all but those who desire to be on the cutting edge and have a willingness to learn how to fix things that break. On fixing broken packages, there is actually a menu selection in Synaptic, at least under Linux Mint, that says Fix Broken Packages. But I found that it does not fix everything that can go wrong with updates and installations. Sometimes you have to use dpkg at the command line to get those fixes to work. The other thing that I hear a lot of complaints about is the number of updates, just like Bill said. After running LMDE for a few months, I have found that the default installation from the original Mint 10 base presents a constant stream of updates. Every day there are between 25 and 100 or more updates. Every day.
Wow. That's,
yeah, that's not something that instills confidence. I discovered that the reason for this is that the LMDE distribution, by default, points to Debian's testing repositories. The Mint team has provided a blog post on how to switch to the incoming or even the latest repositories that they have created. According to the blog post, updates that are placed in testing sometimes will break and get a fix a day or two later. That's why it's called testing. Incoming is a downstream snapshot of the testing repository that is updated from that repository and flags packages with a, quote, update pack, unquote, number. The latest repository relies on the Mint community to determine when a broken package needs to receive the next update pack to become stable. The latest repository is a downstream snapshot of the incoming repository that is updated once a month and contains only packages that have been tested and are stable. That way, you don't get so many updates, and you are guaranteed that the vast majority, if not all, packages are indeed stable. For the Linux Mint user who wants to use LMDE rolling release, but also wants stability, incoming is the one you want. And I'll include a link in the show notes to the blog post that has detailed description on how all of this works. And the bottom line on how to switch to the incoming repository is to edit the sources.list file, as a root user, of course, and repoint the package manager and the updater to the incoming instead of the testing repositories. To sum up the steps in the lengthy blog post explanation, first, you edit the sources.list file as root. You can do that at the command line by typing in sudo space gedit space slash etc slash apt slash sources.list. That's the file. Then you want to comment out the reference to the Debian testing repository. And we'll include a description of what that is, but it is essentially Debian and then a URL to the FTP server followed by the words testing main contrib non-free. And you want to replace that with a reference to Mint's latest repository, which is the word deb and then a path to debian.linuxmint.com/latest, and then follow that by the words testing main contrib non-free. And please don't try to follow that from my verbal description.
Right.
Take a look in our show notes. So, Tom, just to summarize, by default, Linux Mint Debian uses the Debian testing repositories. And as that blog post said, sometimes the things that go into testing are broken.
Get broken, yeah.
And they fix them a day or two later, which is why you end up with so many updates if you keep your Linux Mint Debian pointed at testing. So the Linux Mint community has created these update pack flags so that they take a snapshot of testing every once in a while. They flag those things that are a problem, they fix them, and then they put the latest stable packages in that repository labeled incoming. That's the one you want to point to if you want something a little bit more stable, but you still want a rolling release. And in fact, that is what I have done on my Linux Mint Debian.
Okay.
Because I did find that things were breaking, and because I use this machine for podcasting, to have things break is not all that good. And it's worked out really great. I receive maybe one update a week. And it's so it's really quite nice now.
So by default, everybody's a beta tester.
Yes, and that's kind of the idea behind a rolling release, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you want to use the rolling release, but you don't want to be a beta tester, point your Synaptic Package Manager at the incoming repositories. So that works out really well.
Good. And just to clarify, you said before that while you're editing that file, there's a line that you should comment out. That means that at the very start of the line, you insert an octothorpe, a pound sign, a crosshatch, a tic-tac-toe, whatever you want to call it, and that line will then be ignored.
You've got it exactly.
Okay, well, next up, forgive me if I mispronounce your name, Kareem said, hi, Tom and Larry. Hi, Kareem.
Hi, Kareem.
Or maybe Kareem.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently started listening to podcasts, and I'd like to catch up on a few of the earlier shows in the coming days. The music player on my Android, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that.
That's Kyocera.
Okay, Zio, works just fine for audio files already on my phone. I can even play audio files posted on websites, like podcasts, without downloading them first. The only problem with the latter is that there is not a skip ahead or a skip behind control. This makes it difficult to listen to podcasts in pieces. Also, if the music player is interrupted while listening to the podcast, say by a phone call or incoming text message, or if I open an application on the phone, the audio streaming stops and puts me back at the beginning of the audio. I can always download the audio file on the phone using the data plan or via the computer, but that's very inconvenient and I'd like to skip those steps if possible. Do you have any Android music player replacement that you might recommend for this situation? Thanks, Karim. Larry, you're the Android guy.
Okay, well, First of all, I have tried several music players trying to figure this out, and the only one that I can see that has the skip ahead and skip behind feature is the one that comes directly from the Android marketplace. And it's quite possible that your phone manufacturer, Kyocera, has substituted another player of its own design or some other thing that it thinks it's better that doesn't have that feature. The other thing is that if you do download, and I think you mentioned this, Karim, that if you do download the music first rather than stream it, the player remembers where you left off so that when you go back to play, it starts up where you left off. And when you're streaming, it always goes back to the beginning. And I think that's a limitation of the fact that it is streaming music.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure you can get around that at all. But you might want to just try out the Android marketplace if your phone manufacturer gives you access to it. I've noticed that some of these companies try to make the open source Android operating system more proprietary by locking you down so you can't get everything from the Android marketplace. But there are ways to root your phone and hack it and get into those things. But we won't get into those. This is not an Android podcast. If you want to listen to those, there are plenty of those out there as well. So good luck, Karim. Sorry I haven't been able to help you out too much, but hopefully you'll find something that's suitable in the marketplace.
Media players are kind of cheap these days. And I know that's not your phone, but get yourself a nice Sansa or something.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, let's move on to Jim. Jim describes reinstalling Linux Mint in a dual boot environment. Larry and Tom.
Jim.
I was able to install Linux Mint 11 in place of Linux Mint 10, dual booted with Windows 7, on a Toshiba NB505 netbook very easily once I got to that point. It was not easy getting there. The computer's BIOS all of a sudden stopped seeing an external device connected to it during the boot process. I found a message in the Toshiba message board that there was an update for the BIOS. I ran the update. Problem solved. I had a similar problem to Charlie's on a recent Computer America show. Mine is a Realtek RT8188CE802.11BGN Wi-Fi adapter, Rev01. I wrote to Realtek and Jason responded, giving me a link to download the driver for Linux. I unpacked it with the archive manager and followed the instructions. In a few minutes, the Wi-Fi was up and working. Interestingly enough, when I upgraded the netbook to Linux Mint 11, the driver was recognized out of the box. In the latest episode of Going Linux that I listened to, you were trying to find the keyboard shortcut for the terminal. In Ubuntu-based distros, it is Control-Alt-T. I can open all but one of my most used apps with keyboard. The one exception is Firestarter. For some reason, it just doesn't work. Your podcast has jumped to the number one spot in my podcast list. I have downloaded all the Going Linux podcasts, as well as listening to them as they are released. I am also listening to them in order from the beginning. I am finding useful tips in them, like using Control-L to jump to the address bar of a browser. I use keyboard shortcuts a lot, thus this one was a huge one for me. Thanks for the great podcast. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Jim?
Okay, Jim. Well, here's another one for you. If you're in a browser, hit Control F and a search will open up. There you go.
and by the way, if you're in the Firefox browser, Control Alt T doesn't bring up the menu. It instead opens a duplicate tab.
Oh, that's us.
So you want to be outside of the browser before trying to do that. And, of course, that doesn't work in Linux Mint if you want to start the menu in Linux Mint. You want the control key and then tap the super key, which is the one that, if you're using a non-Mac keyboard, is the key that has that, in most cases, Windows logo.
Yeah,
that's the super key. It's not a Windows key. It's a super key.
Well, Jim also provided a link to a tutorial that helped him, and it's on how to partition your hard drive, and we will put that link in the show notes.
Right. And in a related matter, we got an email from Michael, who wrote, "Hello, Larry and Tom."
Hello, Michael.
I have a Dell 4100 that I was running Windows XP and Ubuntu 10.04 with a dual boot setup with Ubuntu. I removed Ubuntu 10.04 by deleting the Ubuntu partition, and since then I can't get anything to boot up from the hard drive. I tried Derek's Boot and Nuke and Linux Shred command. I'm not even going to read that one. Yes, it ran 100 times. I don't think I needed to do that as many times since that didn't fix my problem. I can boot up Ubuntu 10.04 and 10.10 from the CD, but I can't get either one to run from my hard drive. The restore from Windows XP doesn't seem to boot up either. Can you give me some help on how to fix my problem so I can at least get back to running Ubuntu or something similar, Michael?"
Wow. Okay, the first thing you want to shred is that Windows XP disk.
If it's even a disk, it's probably a restore partition or something on the Dell.
It turns out that Michael had not only wiped out his Linux installation, but had somehow corrupted the disk partition as well. After Larry got him up and running with a new partition, he let us know how it went. And he said again, "Hello, Larry and Tom."
Hello again, Michael.
"If you only read one of my many emails to you on your show, I think this one would be best, so you should use this one. Thanks for all your help getting me this far. Especially your link to the Gparted information, it answered a lot of questions. After all my testing different versions of Linux on my older computer, I found Linux Puppy works the best. So that's what I have installed and I'm using full-time on my computers as my first steps to going Linux. Now here's my question." Oh, he's got another question.
Yes, he does.
"How can I network my Linux machine to my two W machines? Meaning, use the printer connected to my Linux machine or read-write files onto a Linux partition from my Windows machines. Note, my Linux machine is connected to the router with a wire, whereas the other two computers access the router wirelessly. Thanks for all your help."
Well, Michael, thanks very much for the email. I'm glad things are working out for you. And rather than try to answer your question about connecting your W machine, as Tom puts it, to your shared Linux printer and shared drives and so on, we did an episode, actually a couple of episodes, on home networking a little while ago. And we'll provide links in the show notes to those episodes. Listen to those. And those should help you out in making the connections. And if you have questions, get back to us. So I think that's it for our email for today, Tom.
Okay. And I take it you have a software pick. I don't think I do this week.
Okay. Well, there have been plenty of weeks when I haven't had one. So here we go. This one is an application called Tux Boot. And you can get that at tuxboot.org. And what it is it's an application that helps you to create a bootable live USB drive for Clonezilla Live or DRBL Live. And that last one is a diskless remote boot in Linux. It also allows you to create a live USB drive for Gparted Live and Tux2 Live. It's actually a modified version of UNetBootin that allows you to make a live USB drive of live CDs, Linux distributions. But what Tux Boot does is it gives you all these utilities and allows you to do basically create a fix-it USB thumb drive that you can carry around with you. And this version, Tux Boot, actually runs on both Windows and Linux, and you can choose to download the latest version of Clonezilla Live, DRBL Live, Gparted Live from an ISO or zip file, and then create the live USB stick. And I've done that and used it to clone a hard drive from the USB stick, and it works perfectly.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, I guess that's about it. What's our next episode?
Well, next episode will be my appearance on the Mintcast and also my appearance on the NoSillaCast, both of which occurred some time ago, but we have recordings of them, and I want to make them available for people who don't subscribe to those two podcasts and try to get them to subscribe because they're great podcasts.
Good.
So until then, you can go to our articles and show notes on the Going Linux webpage, which is goinglinux.com. And there you can get more information and detailed instructions.
You can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. And remember, if you have a topic you want us to cover on the show, use the Podcast Alley button to leave your topic suggestion while you vote for us on their site.
You can also send us an audio comment by email. We'll play it on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com. And our voicemail is 1-904-468-7889.
And you can follow our show updates on Twitter and Identica. Just look for Going Linux, all one word.
You can download the episodes from the website, or you can use the HTML5 player or the Flash player right there on the show notes page to play them. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
New music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.